From Kinmare to Ballybunion, from Port Magee to Tarbert, your voice in the kingdom, Radio Kerry. The greatest day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
Episode 3 of The Greatest Day recalls the 1909 season. This was the year in which Kerry lost to Cork in the Munster Championship. Dublin beat the Kingdom in the All-Ireland Final. However, the Kingdom ended the season as champions. Throughout this programme, we'll be reproducing extracts from the Kerry Sentinel newspaper, with Gary O'Sullivan lending his voice to the actual match reports of 1909.
Part 1.
It's arguable as to whether any year could match 1909 for drama, off the field at least. The destination of both the provincial and All-Ireland crowns were decided on by the Munster and Central Councils respectively. It was also a year which saw Irish playwright J.M. Singh of Playboy of the Western World fame pass away. In Dublin, George Bernard Shaw's play The Sewing Up of Blanco Posnet was performed despite a censor's ban. The French Assembly passed a law allowing pregnant women 8 weeks' leave from work. Before Kerry had even kicked a ball in the 1909 Championship, they had already lost an All-Ireland final. On February 14, 1909, Kerry played Mayo in what was the 1908 semi-final, winning 2-4 to 1 point. Dublin went on to defeat Kerry 10 points to 3 in the 1908 home decider, played on May 9, 1909. Future Kerry great Pat Aeroplane O'Shea, in his unpublished memoirs, documented that loss and the response by the Kingdom.
For Kerry, 1909 had been a year of mixed fortunes. In May, they had fallen heavily before a fine Dublin team who won the All-Ireland in the score of 10 points to 3. After a suitable period spent licking their wounds and being given a strong transfusion of new blood, back they came for another attempt. Some half-dozen players appeared for the first time, and their youth and keenness, combined with the steadiness of P. Dillon, M. McCarthy, D. Breen, C. Healy, R. Fitzgerald and C. Murphy, made the team a very formidable one indeed.
The actual 1909 Championship saw both Tipperary and Limerick dispatched en route to a Munster final meeting with Cork. However, those opening victories were not as straightforward as the results indicate. Tipperary went down by 2-10 to 5 points, that after only trailing by 5 points to 1 at half-time. Limerick were defeated 2-18 to 1-2, but Kerry only led by the minimum, 1-3 to 1-2 at half-time. On to Cork, with the Munster title at stake in Limerick on September 19th. Paddy Dillon returned between the sticks for this game. Other double All-Ireland winners involved with Kerry this season were Con Healy, Maurice McCarthy and Dick Fitzgerald. Tralee Mitchells and Killarney Crokes once again dominated the Kerry squad. However, Listowel's Jack Kennelly and Paddy Milan, Dingle's Bat O'Connor and Jack McCarthy of Valentia would all be ever-present on the Kingdom side of 1909. Another ever-present that season was team captain Tom Costello. Against Cork, Kerry held a 3-point advantage at half-time, 1-6 to 1-3. However, the main talking point was the display of the referee. Paddy Foley, better known as PF, in his book Kerry's Football Story explained,
"The referee was from a Limerick hurling district, and it became early evident that he knew little about football. First incident to rouse the ire of spectators was when Con Murphy, fielding a high ball, hopped it once and was whistled. Players caught and obstructed each other to their heart's content. The second half became rough, the referee allowing every latitude."
The Kerry man was even less forgiving of the man in the middle.
"Referee Nocton betrayed an incompetence and an ignorance of the rules, which were amazing, and beyond a shadow of doubt, lost Kerry the match."
One incident in particular irked the Kingdom, leading to a walk-off. The Kerry man recalled how,
"The referee was looking in the opposite direction when a Cork man picked a rolling ball clean off the ground with his hands. The player went on to score. Kerry protested and left the field of play. Eventually they were persuaded to continue, but did so under protest."
Cork went on to win 2-8 to 1-7, but their efforts were in vain as a Kerry objection to the validity of the Cork lineup saw the Kingdom awarded the title. PF explains,
"Gerry Beckett was included in the Cork selection. While holidaying in his native Kilgarvan, he played with the village team, which was not affiliated."
Kerry, though, refused to accept the championship, as they had not won it on the playing field. They requested a refixture, which was subsequently granted by the Munster Council. The Sentinel noted how the crowd for this refixture was swelled considerably following a decision by the council to donate the net receipts to the fund in aid of the widow of the recently deceased Tipperary man Bob Quan. The Kerry versus Cork refixture went ahead in front of the biggest crowd at the Cork Athletic Grounds since the famous Kerry Kildare trilogy.
Cork were awarded a free and Mehigan sent in a beauty. Dillon, however, saved beautifully. Cronin sent down a useful centre. The leather went into the thick of the forwards, and in the scramble which followed, Quinlan sent in a minor. McKessie covered some ground before centering across to Reardon, who with the beauty of a screw kick scored Cork's first point. The Corkmen pinned their opponents to their own territory, and a most exciting scene was witnessed outside the posts. Cork were sparing no effort to score, and Kerry were equally keen on preventing it. Kerry were penalised, and this enabled the Corkmen to get clean away, and a free was given to Cork. The leather was placed for Mehigan, who with a well-directed shot sent up the white flag. Immediately from the kick-out, Kerry were again penalised, and Mehigan added a third point. Kerry would not be denied, but one of their forwards held on too long, and Jack Lynch effected a magnificent save. Reardon was prominent in some play, which took Cork up to the post, but McCarthy effected a beautiful save.
The sides retired at half-time, with Kerry trailing by 3-1. It's worth noting that while the Sentinel credits Quinlan with Kerry's sole score of the first half, the Kerryman reporter at the time had a different take on it, stating Dick Fitzgerald was responsible for the point. Such discrepancies were not uncommon at the time. Cork drew first blood in the second period.
Cork were awarded a free and Mehigan placed the first point. Kerry, aided by a good punt by Fitzgerald, sent the game up to the post. Mehigan relieved well, but the leather went to Murphy, who sent in a high one, giving Kerry their second point of the game. Costello's kick sent the ball down to Sullivan, who added another point for the Kingdom. Out in the wing, Kennelly got possession, and with a beauty from a difficult angle, sent in a fine point. Kerry were now level. Cork again took the lead. The kick out afforded but little relief, and Kerry were penalised in the danger zone. The ball was placed for Mehigan, who sent in a useful point, thus giving Cork a lead of 2 points.
Then, with a little under 10 minutes remaining, came the decisive score, as described by the Kerryman.
At this stage of play, one of the nicest bits of football that I have ever seen took place. Dick Fitzgerald received from a long punt from midfield and centred the ball beautifully for Skinner, who receiving and coming on with lightning speed simply mesmerised the Cork custodian, scored a goal amidst thundering applause.
Kerry subsequently closed the game out.
Kerry were now masters of the situation, and the ball being sent back from the kick-out, Quinlan gave his side another point. Cork changed the scene and several efforts were made to score, but they failed to penetrate the defence. Just before the finish, Kerry got away again, and after several had taken part, Fitzgerald added another point.
That made it 1-6 to 6 points. That's how it stood come the full-time whistle. The Kingdom were Munster champions once more.
The game to the finish had many ups and downs, but it must at once be said that the best team won. The Kerrymen were undoubtedly superior in many points of the game, particularly in the scoring line. And while they gave a good deal away in frees, they were able to recover themselves sufficiently to come out victorious. Kerry were well balanced in all departments, and though there might have been some brilliant individual efforts on the other side, they were not sufficient to make up for other deficiencies.
Furthermore, tribute was being paid to the travelling contingent from the Kingdom.
From Kerry there came an enormous crowd, and indeed it is questionable if the followers of any team in Ireland are so loyal to their representatives as those from the Kingdom.
The Kerryman newspaper was also impressed with the display of the Kingdom.
The game was a splendid exhibition of first-class football. During the first half, the Corkmen showed up splendid form, their weight and strength being very telling in their favour. But what the Kerrymen lacked in this respect, they made up in combination and science.
An apparently frivolous Cork objection to the makeup of the Kerry team left the Kerryman's GAA reporter far from pleased.
The Cork objection won't hold well. Cork have placed themselves in a very unenviable light, as Kerry need not have consented to a replay and claimed the match on the spot. It is in keeping with the usual Cork tactics. Conduct of this kind does not speak well for any county. The grounds on which they have based their objections are frivolous and weak, and would not be thought of, much less brought forward by sportsmen in any other county.
The Kerryman newspaper, dated December 4th, detailed the following.
Munster Council met last Sunday to deal with Cork's objection to Kerry in the Munster final replay. First point of objection was that two Kerry players played for Listowel against Ballybunion, a non-affiliated club, on August the 29th, but Kerry said the affiliation fee had been lodged in May. Secondly, Cork argued that a member of the Kerry team was suspended by his club, Valencia. Kerry argued that by the rules, the member referred to was not given sufficient notice of the complaint against him. Thirdly, a member of the Kerry team played for Kickens against Geraldines in the Dublin Football League on October the 24th, and Kerry considered that he played a friendly match only.
It was moved and seconded that the match be awarded to Cork. It went to a vote. After beating Cork on the field of play, they also defeated the Moffat by 5-3. Amazingly, this hearing took place a week after Kerry's All-Ireland semi-final victory over Mayo. The Kerryman reporter had been most incensed at the actions of Cork in the wake of the Munster final replay. Ahead of that semi-final with Mayo, the same scribe was expressing his displeasure at the Kerry selectors.
Frank J. Cronin is not included. From accounts to hand, it appears he was not at the top of his form on Sunday against Cork, but that should not account for his losing place. He is, and always has been, one of the best in the Kerry 17. There are men picked to play against Mayo who on several occasions were more open to censure and rebuke owing to their bad play than he ever was, and whose names were not removed from the playing list. The selection committee have been, for some years, been in the habit of saddling the team with a certain number of crocs, and they are sending some of that class to Ennis.
Cronin's place on the team to face Mayo in Ennis went to Jack Rice of Tralee. William Flynn of Tralee became Kerry's third goalkeeper of the season. Dan Mullins had played in the opening two rounds in Munster.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 2.
For the second season running, yet within the space of 9 months owing to the lateness of the 1908 Championship, Kerry were to account for Mayo in an All-Ireland semi-final.
Some long kicks brought the ball back to Mayo ground. And after some exchanges, a splendid save by Sweeney raised cheer. Immediately after, the leather was rushed down the ground and Quinlan's centering quickly enabled Dick Fitzgerald to put the first score, a minor to the credit of Kerry. Mayo was not long in also equalising and in a minute or so again raised the white flag. Within the next 3 minutes, both sides scored. In some fast play, Quinlan was prominent. Sweeney again drew cheers from his excellent saving tactics. Soon after, Con Murphy scored a nice point off a free for Kerry, and soon after, Dick Fitzgerald, off another free, scored another minor for Kerry. Then the leather was nicely passed to Skinner, and he scored again for Kerry.
The first of Kerry's goals followed, as described by the Kerryman.
Connor returned to Kennelly, who sent to Sullivan, the latter player being immediately responsible for a major.
The second goal, again described by the Kerryman, arrived just shy of half-time.
Rice was once more fouled and Tom Costello, taking the kick, sent the ball to the mouth of the goal and Skinner put in Kerry's second major.
That second goal gave Kerry a 2-5 to 4 points advantage at the break. Mayo responded early in the second half, but Kerry once more took over.
With some long kicking, Kerry, showing better concerted play, got the ball to their opponent's ground and raised the white flag several times. From this to the end, they had all the better of the game. The boys from the Kingdom showed themselves much the better footballers and ran out easy winners.
The result read 2-12 to 6 points. A 6-point margin in 1908 was doubled in 1909, a fact not lost on the Kerryman.
Kerry's victory against Ballina was one of the most decisive ever witnessed. As was anticipated by the followers, the Kerry boys were the victors, but the score was heavier than anticipated. Kerry was unquestionably better. They showed better combination and more finesse, and were also faster on the ball.
Despite the decisive nature of the defeat of Mayo, the Kerryman was not fully appreciative of the Kingdom's display.
The Kerry players were once more at fault in their fouling practices, giving away several scores. If they persist, it is within the range of possibility to see Louth romping home in the All-Ireland final. Kerry has at present a splendid chance of annexing the final. They know their weak points. They should leave nothing to chance, as Louth are wonderful footballers.
Louth won through to the decider with a 2-13 to 15 points defeat of Antrim. That 1909 final against Louth was a rarity in that it was played in the actual year. Jack Rice had taken Frank J. Cronin's place for the semi-final, but Cronin was restored to the starting 17 for the decider on December 5th. Goalkeeper Paddy Dillon also returned. The Kerryman newspaper paints the picture of All-Ireland final day.
Sunday was Kerry's day out, and the streets of the metropolis resounded to the tones of the soft Kerry Doric. Familiar faces were to be met in nearly all the public thoroughfares, wearing their green and gold badges, and the general air of jubilation proved the boys were there for a purpose.
PF spoke of the conditions facing the players and the impatience of the supporters.
It was an ideal winter evening, clear and cold. Frost during the previous night with a subsequently early morning thaw made the ground slippery. Arrangements to cope with the large attendance proved entirely futile. The crowd, following a long wait, became impatient and, in their intense desire to see the match, rushed the entrance.
The first half of the encounter was a classic nip-and-tuck affair.
Louth lost no time in putting Kerry to the preliminary test, which evoked a spirited response, and for some minutes it was a desperate onslaught. At the crucial moments, mistakes were manifest on either side. Louth missed badly when a score was well within reach. The battle raged furiously, and Kerry, by some skillful footwork, returned and, receiving a free, there was every prospect of a score, but the opportunity was lost. Carvin was responsible for the first score in the contest, landing a cleverly obtained point for Louth. Kennelly at last broke through, and his movement was well supported by Jim Rice, and O'Sullivan, picking up smartly and delivering equally efficiently, shot a neat minor for the Kingdom. In the next bout, Louth secured a free. It was a dangerous situation for the opposing side until Dillon jumped out and, with a marvellous display, which was certainly magnificent, averted danger. Louth got a 50 far out, and but for Costello, who saved magnificently, a goal looked within the reach of Louth. Louth forwards, combining well, a terrific rush was brought off. Matthews winding up with a point for Louth. Kerry were given some nice openings, but could not utilise them. It was a pity that in the frees given Kerry, they seemed unable to accept them. They repeatedly brought the leather right up to Loud's posts and, from exceptionally favourable placings, made but poor progress. Quinlan, with Loud's posts completely at his mercy, muffed very badly. A free to Louth was taken by Carvin, who quickly found Kerry's posts at the cost of a minor. The turn of the tide soon came, Costello sending in a point for Kerry, and Skinner, who was playing a great game for Kerry, pulled off a like score. The jubilation of Kerry followers was unbounded, and it reached a climax when Skinner got through for a goal.
It's worth quoting PF's description of that Skinner goal.
A lengthy ball was clutched securely by Fitzgerald. Two Louth backs pounced upon him, but the irrepressible Dick swerved clear and short passed to Skinner, whose shot shook the net.
That goal gave Kerry the edge at half-time, 1-3 to 3 points. When play recommenced,
the Kerry defence had to go down before Morgan, who caused the white flag to be hoisted in favour of the Louth men. Kerry were soon occupying an advantageous position, and the collapse of Louth's defence was imminent, but the penalising of Kerry, while it brought much-needed relief to Louth, lost Kerry the substantial headway made. The penalty was for glaring overholding, and the free took place almost at the mouth of Kerry's goal. Carvin experienced little difficulty in sending through the uprights. A further penalty had to be paid of Kerry, but they were decidedly lucky for their efforts failed by inches. Sullivan put in an excellent display and supplemented Kerry's score by a point. Kerry were now unmistakably obtaining the upper hand in the open play and had matters much to their liking. Dick Fitzgerald took a free, and though the point which he secured didn't look too probable, the Kerry men got there all right. A free to Louth followed, and C. Murphy averted danger in the nick of time. It was not long when Murphy had another essay, and though he was hard-pressed at every inch, he rushed through a point for the Kingdom. Skinner followed suit, and the game was now in the safekeeping of Kerry, who gave little away. The Kerry backs at this stage were unbeatable, and though the onslaughts were terrific, Dillon was always trustworthy.
Victory and the All-Ireland was Kerry's on a scoreline of 1-9 to 6 points.
Kerry's superiority was unmistakably shown during the concluding half, when they made rings around their opponents. At the same time, it must be stated that there was a good deal of muffing on the part of some of the leading players in the Kerry side. But taking the battle as it went, the Kerry men have not only won, but have won on their merits.
Future Kerry great Pat Aeroplane O'Shea was among the crowd of 15,000 to witness the Kingdom reclaim the All-Ireland title. In O'Shea's unpublished memoirs, he recalled that final against Louth.
Louth played fast, clean football, but the going was heavy due to frost overnight and a subsequent thaw, and this favoured Kerry somewhat. The Kingdom led at half-time and won comfortably in the second half.
The Kerryman reporter was also in jubilant form.
Up Kerry! The old cry has taken on again and is now shouted out with such a spirit as it was a few years ago. The delight was great when it came known that our boys from the Kingdom had once again annexed All-Ireland honours. When the tidings arrived on Sunday night, the shout, Up Kerry, caught on like fire, and before half an hour, everybody knew that the victory was Kerry's.
Elsewhere in the same edition of the Kerryman, another writer was heaping praise on the newly crowned champions.
If any doubts existed in the minds of the Kerry Gaels as to the ability of the present 17, Sunday's great victory at Jones's Road, Dublin, must have sent them at rest. Kerry's victory was a great and popular one. They played a great game on Sunday last and won the match on merits. The Louth men were a hard nut to crack, but somehow it was up to Kerry to do the cracking and they did it. We wish the boys every success and hope that now they have added the third All-Ireland to their credit. They will never stop until they make it at least a clear half dozen.
The same paper poetically proclaimed,
Just as the shades of the short winter afternoon were drawing to a close, the citizens of Dublin and the 15,000 who had assembled to witness the battle royale knew that the object had been effected and that Kerry were once again football champions of Ireland.
GAA historian Father Tom Looney says the master Dick Fitz was again one of the main reasons behind the success of 1909.
In the 1909 campaign, with the troubles with Cork, in fairness, Cork beat them. There was a rematch. The men from Macroom had a big strong team. Kerry won the rematch, so therefore they're Munster champions. They went on to play and they easily beat Mayo in the All-Ireland semi-final by a score of 2 goals and 12 points, which is a good score to 6 points. Now they're in to meet Louth from the wee county, as it's called. And 15,000 people went to that game in Jones's Road, as it was called at the time. And Kerry won that game by double scores, 1-9 to 6 points. So that was Kerry's third All-Ireland. Dick Fitzgerald was very kind of prominent in that whole campaign, probably the best forward in the country, you know. But Louth had a good team, and there were a lot of ground football skills, which Dick Fitzgerald always actually proposed in his book later in 1914. But it was a good win. They had a flyer on that team, which Dick Fitzgerald had brought into the squad. I think he helped to get a job for him in Killarney in the hospital. He was John Skinner, came from Mitchelstown in North Cork, and he was a brilliant footballer. He later left Kerry to get a job in Clonmel and played against Kerry in the Tipperary colours, you know. Matt O'Connor, who'd been also playing with Nils of Cork, figured in that team, and his son and grandson figured later on Kerry All-Ireland winning sides as well. So it's a lovely kind of connection in one Dingle family, the O'Connors, you know.
The son of Matt O'Connors, which Father Looney refers to, is John O'Connor, who won his All-Ireland against Kerry for Galway in 1938. Bat's grandson Vincent was a used sub in the Kingdom's All-Ireland final win of 1979. The title champions of Ireland may have been won on the pitch, but it then had to be secured off it. Just like Cork when it came to the Munster Championship, Louth objected to the makeup of the newly crowned national winners. The six counts in which they based their objection were not dissimilar to Cork's. The accusations, as appeared in the 1970s publication Years of Glory, were that 1. MJ Quinlan played foreign games. 2. Frank J. Cronin played in the Dublin Football League. 3. Kerry sub John Casey played under an assumed name after transferring from Valencia. 4. Paddy Milan played against Ballybunion, an unaffiliated club. 5. Jack Kennelly committed a similar breach. And 6. Jack McCarthy took part in an illegal match. Central Council met on January 2nd, 1910 to rule on the matter. 3 of the points of objection were answered successfully, while Louth withdrew the others. The Kilmoyle and Ballyduff hurling clubs could also be thanked.
The champion club could only select players from their own club. They quite blissfully disregarded that and went on to win the 1891 championship. Now, what they did was that one of the clubs, Kilmoyle, disbanded. But there seems to have been a huge falling off. An awful lot of those players didn't play hurling ever again, either for their club or their county. I don't know why this happened, Was there issues of legality? Were they playing with unaffiliated clubs in the middle of that Parnell split when half the clubs weren't affiliated within counties? Or there may have been an issue also over the payment of their rail tickets. As far as I know, they were never reimbursed for the rail tickets, which were expensive, maybe a week's wages for a labourer at the time. They were never reimbursed for their tickets on the travelling to the All-Ireland final. It was a huge move because instantly every county in the country saw this as a way of winning All-Ireland championships, and the GAA moved swiftly to change the rule that the champion club could now pick players from within the county, anywhere within the county. So even though you still had one club teams playing right up till the late 1890s, in the case of Tipperary, from 1892 on, even though the club name went on the trophy and went on the roll of honour, it was effectively a county team.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles, brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 3.
60 years after Kerry had won the 1909 Munster and All-Ireland finals, a provincial championship medal from 09 was found in the Tralee CBS playing pitch. Kerryman newspaper reporter John Barry detailed how the medal was inscribed with the name B. O'Connor, as in Bat O'Connor. In a follow-up article, John Barry reported that the medal had been claimed by John O'Connor. John O'Connor then revealed that Bat O'Connor's All-Ireland medal of the same year had also been lost. In his book, The History of Gaelic Football, Owen Curry quotes the Freeman's Journal as stating that the 1909 All-Ireland final between Kerry and Louth was, from every point of view, undoubtedly the finest exposition of the Gaelic code ever witnessed. That Kerry display had won the county its third All-Ireland Senior Football Championship and a first for the kingdom since the back-to-back successes of 1903 and 04. Paddy Foley's book, published in 1945, called Kerry's Football Story, paid tribute to members of that victorious side of 1909. Captain Tom Costello.
Grand fielder with tremendous kick. Later held the mighty Skinner up when the latter was playing for Tip.
Dick Fitzgerald.
Filled different forward positions for Kerry. Became famous in the Kerry-Kildare games, where he screwed balls between the posts from impossible angles. Brought science to bear on attacking movements, the most colourful personality the game has ever known.
Cork-born Johnny Skinner.
Took up Gaelic football in Killarney, and under Dick Fitzgerald's coaching, learned all the tricks of the game, and some more besides. One of the best forwards of the day. Great opportunist, deadly accurate.
Had the Footballer of the Year accolades been in existence in 1909, Skinner would have been a leading candidate. His goals that year were vital. One in the Munster final refixture against Cork, another in the All-Ireland semi-final victory over Mayo, then the only goal of the All-Ireland final against Louth. It's impossible to document Skinner's overall scoring tally for the season. In addition to there being very little coverage of the earlier rounds of the Munster Championships, there's also discrepancies in exactly what Skinner scored in that season's final. Depending on the source, he scored anywhere between 1-3 and 1-7. Skinner that season was winning his first All-Ireland. He would go on to secure two more, as would Con Murphy, Tom Rice and that season's captain, Tom Costello. In 1909, Dick Fitzgerald and Maurice McCarthy were each winning their third medals, and they were not finished yet. John Casey and Con Clifford are the two substitutes listed for the 1909 final victory against Louth. Casey was the sole used sub. Clifford's time would come in 1913 and 1914. Kerry had nine ever-presents in that championship-winning season of 1909. The men who played every one of the six matches were Tom Costello, Ned Spillane, Con Murphy, Bat O'Connor, Paddy Milan, Jack Kennelly, Jack McCarthy, John O'Sullivan and MJ Quinlan. The manner in which Kerry were finally proclaimed 1909 championships can be viewed as surreal, following the objections by Cork and Louth, which resulted in both Munster and All-Ireland titles being won at council meetings in addition to on the field of play. However, the way in which the kingdom surrendered the title without losing a game is arguably the most bizarre and unfortunate the association has ever seen. Defending champions Kerry reached the 1910 decider, where they were to play Louth once again. The wee county were hoping and expecting to gain revenge for the 1909 final defeat, but they never got the opportunity. The kingdom refused to travel for the decider following a disagreement with the railway company. Legendary GAA correspondent Paddy Foley, who went under the moniker PF, recounted the story in his book Kerry's Football Story.
The Great Southern Rail Company management of the time was regarded in Gaelic circles as hostile to the national games. excessive fares were often charged and proper travelling facilities were not provided. Kerry spectators to big matches at Thurles were entertained on two occasions for the return journey from the Cattle Bank. Two trains then ordinarily left Tralee for Dublin on Saturday. The players always had to make the trip on the second. Latter was slow and generally overcrowded, arriving late in Dublin. Players in twos or threes were mixed up with the ordinary passengers. Confusion was increased at Killarney, where Saturday was market day, and country shoppers boarded the train with basket bags and parcels. There was widespread resentment at the uncompromising attitude of the railway company. In reply to strong representations, the Kerry team had been granted a through carriage for the 1909 final.
However, a similar request for the 1910 decider was rejected. Kerry were so displeased at the way they had been treated by the railway company that they opted not to travel for the final. The Kerry Weekly Reporter noted in its issue of Saturday, November 19, 1910, that Central Council was to meet that evening.
A semi-official explanation issued practically exonerates Kerry for not travelling. It was arranged that the Kerry team, 20 in number, would travel by the 3:20pm train from Tralee on Saturday, but on receipt of the voucher on Thursday, it was found that the provision of the reserved carriage was not forthcoming. No more than a voucher for 20 of their followers, who also wanted to travel on Saturday at excursion rates.
This reserve carriage was subsequently granted, but as the paper reports,
it was expected in Tralee that when the railway company granted the reserve carriage, that they would go the whole hog and grant the terms asked for, to the reduced number of 12, but the company did not do so, and Kerry declared off then.
Opinion was divided on Kerry's stance. PF speaks of public bodies in Kerry endorsing the player's stance, so too nationalist organisations throughout the country, but PF also reports of Dublin County Board condemning the actions and calling for Kerry to be expelled from the association for 5 years.
Kerry's action created a sensation and widespread disappointment. Many people thought that having beaten Louth the previous year by double scores, it was extremely foolish to throw away a further All-Ireland title. Others held that the principal was involved and that the time had arrived to join issue with the railway company. Public bodies in Kerry, by resolution, endorsed the attitude of the players. National organisations throughout the country did likewise. The Munster counties supported Kerry's gesture. Many of them applauded it. On the other hand, at a meeting of the Dublin County Board, the action of the Kerrymen was strongly condemned. The situation was fraught with serious consequences for the association. A worthy warfare ensued. It was carried into the newspapers. Many letters appeared expressing various views.
Central Council met twice on the issue. On the first occasion, opinion from the various counties was split, while according to the Kerry Sentinel, the Dublin delegate, after calling for the 5-year ban on the Kerry officers and players, asked that there be no compromise, for that he put forward would open to any other county to act as Kerry had done. As PF told, support came from a surprising source given the recent acrimony.
When the Dublin resolution calling for the expulsion of Kerry was announced, a well-known Cork Gael rejoined, "If Kerry go into the wilderness, we go with them." He expressed the feelings of the rebel county.
When the second meeting of the Central Council took place on Sunday, December 4th, Austin Stack of Kerry, according to the Kerry Sentinel, questioned whether Dublin's motion was in order as Kerry had given the requisite 3 days' notice. The Sentinel detailed how the rule, Dublin were quoting, looking for Kerry to be punished, could only refer to individuals. Therefore, Dublin asked for the team to be suspended, while Belfast looked for a 6-month ban instead of 5 years. According to the Sentinel, the chairman said they had no rule authorising them to suspend Kerry, and he ruled the motion and the amendment out of order. There was then a call to refix the match, but this was defeated by 7-6, and Louth were declared All-Ireland champions. Kerry player of the time, Denny Breen, in his 1963 interview with the Irish Press, recalled the events of 1910.
A dispute arose with the Great Southern Rail Company, a body that was not given to lavishing favours on an organisation such as the GAA, and we decided not to travel. Thus, we forfeited the chance to defend our laurels. Louth were awarded the game, and though some of the Central Council wanted to suspend Kerry, they thought better of it when Kerry's action was supported by Cork and Tipperary.
Pat Aeroplane O'Shea that year made his Kerry debut. His unpublished memoirs give a fascinating insight into his personal feelings on the situation.
The championship ties in 1910 were late as usual, and the final was fixed for the 13th of November, which of course was regarded by the wise ones as an unlucky omen. Unlucky it proved to be, for with less than a week to go, Kerry announced that they would not play, owing to the Great Southern Railway's refusal to grant decent travelling facilities. This grievance had been coming to a head over the years and now exploded with the suddenness and devastating shock of an atom bomb. Many hoped that the railway company would climb down, but they remained stiff-necked and difficult, as only monopolists can be, and hope was finally abandoned. To me, personally, the stand down was a grievous disappointment. But I had to admit, as I still do, that the protest was timely and in fact overdue. Moreover, it was a success, and from then onwards, no serious complaints arose about travel arrangements. A motion that Kerry be suspended for 5 years came before the Central Council. Austin Stack, the Kerry representative, pointed out that Kerry had given notice of withdrawal required by the rules and could not therefore be penalised. The motion was declared out of order and Louth were declared All-Ireland champions. There was, to put it mildly, great disappointment in Kerry on learning that the Leinstermen had accepted the title. There was surprise and anger at the action of some counties within easy striking distance of Dublin, whose representatives sought to banish Kerry from the association for insisting on the same treatment as was given to the followers of foreign games. Kerry did not turn the other cheek to the smitter, however. John Mitchells promptly issued a challenge to Louth to play a match in Dublin. The championship to be at issue. The receipts to go to the Dr. Crokes, Wolfe Tones and Parnell Memorials. And Kerry foregoing all claim to medals if they won. Kerry County Board sent a similar challenge. No reply was received to either communication.
So Louth, by default, were All-Ireland champions. Paddy Foley's book, Kerry's Football Story, goes on to tell how...
At a subsequent meeting of the Central Council, Mr. O'Toole stated as the final was not played, there were no funds on hand, and that the council could not buy the All-Ireland medals for Louth.
PF quotes Kerryman writer PJ O'Shea stating that Central Council should buy leather medals and present them to Louth because paper champions, as he called them, richly deserved such trophies. That was not the end of the matter, as PF recalled.
The entire incident had a disturbing effect in Kerry and threatened wider repercussions. A suggestion was made that the county withdraw from the association and that a Munster body, independent of the Central Council, be established. A serious split in the association once looked likely, but wiser councils prevailed under the healing balm of time. Moreover, there came a revolutionary change in the attitude of the railway company to travelling Gaelic teams. If the Kerry players in our time can journey in comfort to Dublin in corridor carriages, if teams through the country generally are accorded first-class travelling facilities, let them remember these concessions were only secured by the sacrificing of an All-Ireland. Through the arches of the years, let all Gaels applaud Kerry's gallant 1910 stand-down.
The immediate fallout from the dispute with the railway company and Louth receiving a walkover in that 1910 All-Ireland final was that Kerry defender Maurice McCarthy sensationally quit the inter-county game. Revenge may be too strong a word, but Kerry would gain redemption against Louth, albeit 3 years later. They would do so in the famed Croke Memorial Final. A competition held to raise funds in order to honour the memory of the first patron of the GAA, Archbishop Croke, a man with strong Kerry connections. The Croke Memorial Final, which saw the aforementioned Maurice McCarthy come out of retirement, was also the foundation for All-Ireland No. 4 for the Kingdom. The Croke Memorial Final was to have far greater ramifications for the GAA as a whole. That story is one for the next episode, though. This one celebrates the All-Ireland title triumph of 1909, with Tom Costello and his charges putting Kerry at the summit of football.
Listen, Asthore, for these old eyes are sealed. Listen once more. When the Kerry men take the field, tell an old man who has seen them in days of old, do they walk proudly still, wearing the green and gold? Tell me, Asthore, whenever I hear the cheers, whose is the score? And I'll remember the years when I was young and my limbs were strong and bold, for 'tis many a year since I wore the green and gold. Tell me a story if they play in the same old way, leaping high for the ball and sending away far up the field for the forwards to reach and hold and swerve and steady and score for the green and gold. Do they walk proudly, dark heads handsome and high, like in the days I'll be dreaming of till I die? For Kerry will call me till my heart grows cold, like the boys who are gone and wore the green and gold. Listen, Asthore, when the play is robust and rough and heads become wild, are these lads manly enough just for a moment the other man's hand to hold in a brother's grip for the sake of the green and gold? Listen, Asthore, they have come from a place that's proud, where hearts beat high for Ireland and hearts were bowed, from people who fought and suffered but never sold that heritage guarded and girt by the green and gold. Listen, Asthore, when the Kerrymen take the field, tell me when they're attacking and when they yield. Say if they fail, Asthore, I am blind and old, but tell me they'll not dishonour the green and gold.
You've been listening to The Greatest Day, a 36-part series documenting the story of Kerry's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories. The Greatest Day was presented by John Drummy, written by Joe O'Mahony, and researched and produced by the Radio Kerry Sports team. This programme was made with the support of the Sound and Vision Broadcast Funding Scheme, a BCI initiative.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Next week on The Greatest Day.
Three weeks prior to that championship opener against Clare, Kerry had played Louth at Jones's Road, Dublin, in the final of the Croke Memorial. It was seen as something of a grudge match.
The last whistle went almost immediately, a miraculous escape for Kerry.
Kerry then had the ball in the Wexford net, twice.
When the history of the movement is written, Kerry's name will be found emblazoned in letters of gold.
There's no doubt that the key artist, the man who decided how the new field positions should be played, was Dick Fitzgerald.